And we're back with another episode of What in the World. We have Dave Burke.
Hello.
Lisa Frith.
Hello.
And Ayamina Tara. And for
she didn't leave this time, just for the record.
I'm trying very hard to sit on my hands. For those of you who are new to the podcast, we talk about all kinds of interesting metaphysical and otherworldly stuff, mostly with my compatriots here asking me questions and me pulling things out of the Akashic. So what are we talking about today?
No, you said you wanted to circle
In our last podcast, at one point when we were speaking of sacred geometry, you were getting a hit from Lord Melchizedek, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if we missed that off-ramp or we could...
No, we can always talk about Melchizedek. That's fine. One of the things that's important to note about Melchizedek is that Melchizedek is... there's a couple of things. Okay, fine. We're going to chatter all at once at me about various things. Okay. For those of you who don't know, when I get information, sometimes it's got too many layers and I have to unpack the thing. Anyway, so Melchizedek, first of all, was originally in quotes, human. He was Enoch. And he's not actually, we consider Melchizedek to actually, or the energy of what Enoch was, to have created two archangels, not one. So we've got Melchizedek and we've got Sandalphon, which kind of hold the top and the bottom of the Tree of Life. But they're actually the same energy, and they're not even necessarily twin flame. It's just two sides of the same coin. And Sandalphon is the receptive energy of that, and Metatron is the... We went from Melchizedek to Metatron. That's fun. Okay, fine. Metatron is the active impulse of that. And the Melchizedek stuff is essentially the priests of that information. Because, you know, as much as we talk about Lord Melchizedek, it's not a singular being. It's a school or a group, a cohort.
A cabal?
Sure. And so the Melchizedeks were the priests of that sacred geometry school.
Ah.
And so when people like talk to Melchizedek, you know, what they're really doing is they're accessing the information of the school of Metatron.
Excellent. And I think that was my bad, actually, because I think in the previous podcast you did bring up Metatron and I transposed it in my head.
Oh, well, yeah. But... Yeah. There's your flow right there. That's why. It's okay. And I picked up on the energy of what you were saying. And yeah. Yay. Anyway, so humans are funny. And the beings that interact with humans are funny. In that we feel we have to quantify things on a level that folks from other places, other planes, other matrices don't feel need quantifying. So when we start working with sacred geometry, if we're following Metatron, if we're following the Melchizedek teachings, there is a math component that gets brought into it that doesn't necessarily have to be there, except for the fact that what we're doing is we are taking information that is universal and we're trying to teach it to people, namely humans, who don't have the language and the concept for it, and so we have to use math. Does that make sense? There was just this whole like download that happened for me, and I'm trying to like parse it. So so reversing that, we don't have the base concepts for how to create necessarily, because we've forgotten that information as we keep shifting our vibration on this planet. And so when the ancients came here and wanted to teach us that, and when and created an order of priests to help us learn sacred geometry, they did it with math because that's the universal language, going back to that universal language of math. Because words don't always work, you know? And humans have... So, originally, even here, language was not used for communication. Language was used for creation. And as we shifted our vibration multiple times, it got corrupted and we forgot how powerful language is because it's an electrical impulse that is then voiced outward. And it should be used for creation, you know, what some people call magic or spellcasting, not for communication. We used to just share ideas. And when you're sharing ideas, you can be a lot more precise than if you're trying to language it out, because you're sending something through an intermediary that goes like, you know. So if I'm talking to you, I'm essentially talking into a point in between us. So I've got my filter on my language. The language goes into that point in between us, has its own filter, and then comes back out to you through your filter. And so it's not direct and it's imprecise. Whereas if you use math, math just is.
Yes, math is pure.
Yeah. So it's a lot better way to communicate important information like creation. And the place where the priests of Melchizedek start with teaching humans about creation is teaching us about our own energy fields, you know? Yeah. And it's interesting because what they do is they talk about the geometric structure within the sphere, you know? But what creation actually is the sphere itself, but they can't get us to make that leap without the math, therefore the geometric structures within the sphere. The platonic
okay.
solids.
Okay.
The geometric stuff is what happens on the way to creation. The sphere is actually creation. You know, it's the internal structure, it's the bones of the actual creation. But we couldn't make that leap without having those bones. And it's very interesting because the information that comes through the Melchizedek stuff has become very rigid in terms of how it's imparted. There are a couple of different branches of the school, so you'll find like different ways in on the information depending on who's teaching it, kind of thing. You know, what human has been approached by a priest. But it always comes back to this rigid idea of, no, it has to be done according to this formula, because when the energy was first being imparted, it had to be done according to the formula, otherwise we didn't get it.
Right.
You know? But we've evolved enough now that we can just kind of swoop in, or a lot of us can anyway, into like the idea of creation and do it organically without formulae. And there's this pushback because now, you know, these ancients and the priests of the ancients who were bringing us all of this new amazing information have now gotten rigid and old school. Because we've moved past the energy that they were used to teaching at. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. It almost makes me want to put with the rigidity and the structure, that it's almost like an old school, like the masculine paradigm that we see shifting into the more of a feminine,
yeah,
softer creation.
Absolutely.
Paradigm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And are there, for lack of a better word, schools for that, or leaning towards the goddesses of old, or?
Well, so, so in terms of like teaching and holding energy and stuff like that, the masculine is external. You know, we go to a school, we talk to a priest, you know, that kind of stuff. Whereas the feminine energy, the feminine divine, if you will, is internal.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a gnosis. You know, someone can help you, lead you into the space where you can have gnosis.
Nice.
But gnosis is internal. And so it's really a matter of sitting with the, I am in the void, I do the thing.
Beautiful.
All of the motion in goddess energy, all of the action in goddess energy, it's not that there isn't action in the receptive side of the tree, it's just that all of the action is under the surface. It's not external.
Perfect.
So yeah, it's something to experiment and play with, and I think we're at a point now where we can do that much more easily, much more effectively. We don't need those math concepts. And I mean, you're welcome to start from the math concepts and then deconstruct that and go, okay, so how do I do that organically without the thinky bit of it?
Well, and I think that there's, as my personal human, I mean, I do much better when I have a structure and a foundation and, for lack of better words, a level of confidence. And then I can go forth and frost the cake, for lack of better words.
I would suggest to you, though, that confidence is not true confidence because it's based on external information. True confidence comes from within, from connecting into that divine self, the goddess within, whatever you want to call it, and that applies to both men and women.
Right, of course.
Because we all hold both sides of that energy. The internal, the gnosis, if you can develop self-confidence based on simply knowing who you are and what your connection to the universe is, or how you create the hologram, or however you want to look at that, that is true self-confidence. That's something that can't be taken away. If you allow it to be external, it's always tenuous.
Beautiful.
And I have stunned everyone into submission.
No, my brain is stuck on something.
Okay,
actually.
Well, share.
And so, I mean, talking about sacred geometry and which takes my brain into physics and considering, you know, when we talk about interdimensional beings, interplanar beings, if you draw a distinction between those two things, you know, does physics operate in a different way in different places? And so therefore, you know, to make it grokkable, we have to break it down even further purely into numbers that can be digested first.
Sure.
So then that leads to sacred numbers.
Mm.
And I'm going to go back to Graham Hancock. And actually, one his second book, Fingerprints of the Gods, he posited that there is a sacred number that is 72.
Okay.
And so first your reaction on that, because it gets deeper than that.
Sure.
And it's evident, just to kind of tie it back to what we've talked about last pod, into Angkor Wat and Giza.
Okay. So for the first thing that comes up when you say 72 is that 72 is a Hebrew mysticism number. It's the number of the names of God. From a math point of view, you know, it's 6 times 12, which is fascinating in and of itself. So, yeah, it absolutely has a tie-in to, like, Sumerian stuff and Egyptian stuff because we're basing it on a base 12 system, essentially. So there's that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, going back to, you know, other stuff, you know, pure numbers and stuff like that, even if you're going to talk about pure sacred numbers, you have to establish what base you're working with before you actually know what that number means.
Right.
You know, it's all going to be, until you establish what base you're using, it's all going to be ratios anyway.
Right.
Look at me, the person who hated math and stuff. thanks, Spirit.
Loved you.
So this is what Dad was talking about. Okay. Sorry, my dad was a world famous niche mathematician dude. Anyway. I'm not sure if I can go to the idea of one sacred number.
Yeah, he didn't posit that that was the only one.
Okay.
That,
but it's
that
a very central one.
A lot of the construction and especially the aesthetics of things in those areas came about based on the number 72. And it got pretty involved into the point where if you take half of 72, well, if you take half of half, which would be a quarter of 72, then add that, that's the number of serpents that appear on a certain edifice. And just these derivations of 72, whether you break it down or blow it up, keep reoccurring.
So here's the thing about numbers that I've always found fascinating,
mm-hmm.
is that when people start getting into the numbers, like on a like sacred spiritual level, they get noodly as fuck. And suddenly everything is about the numbers and there may be, I would suggest, perhaps a certain amount of confirmation bias that happens.
Sure.
You know, if I decide that everything is based on 72, then I'm going to figure out how everything fits
sure.
into the model of 72. It's very challenging to just look at the raw data and not go, this has to fit with that, that has to fit with this.
Well, humans themselves look for patterns because
right.
there's comfort in that.
Well, and you know, I'm a shaman. I love pattern recognition.
Yeah.
And I have to guard against things like confirmation bias.
Right.
You know, I mean, the universe is made up of patterns. There's a reason we recognize them, because they exist. And we run into the problem that a lot of people will start to try to shove everything into a perceived pattern that may not belong in it. There are multiple patterns, you know. Yeah, they all go back to that original, like, substance, energy, whatever. But because everything is made up of it, I don't know that we can ever, at least at this point in time where our consciousness is, recognize what that is, because everything is made up of it. That original substance, energy, whatever. But yeah, every time I come across somebody who's doing, like, some sacred number stuff, it starts to get so noodly that I start laughing. You know, and I mean, you know, I adore Graham Hancock stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know. And he may have gotten stuck in the noodly bit on that.
Sure.
I don't know. Yes, 72 is an important number. It is a sacred number. It shows up in places all over the place. But when you start extrapolating like half and quarter and oh my God, and then we add and stuff, I'm like, that may be stretching it too far.
Yeah.
Especially when we don't know necessarily what the base of the numbering system is that they were using. 72 definitely does speak to creation, otherwise the Hebrews wouldn't have said that, you know, there were 72 names of God. And I do like the fact that when you break it down, it's 6 times 12, because 12 is absolutely one of the lower super sacred numbers, as is 13. I just find myself, like, whenever I find somebody getting super noodly with numbers, kind of taking a step back and then feeling like I need to reality check. Not necessarily them, they can have whatever existence they want, but myself. Because it feels like I'm getting pulled into something that I don't need to be pulled into. I don't know how else to put it. It's sort of like my reaction to certain like politicians and public speakers, where I'm like, I see what you're doing there and I don't want to play. there's sort of a hypnotic aspect to it. I mean, numbers can be very hypnotic because it's a rhythm, it's a pattern, and that's something that we can get lost in. And I don't believe that anything that's truly going to empower me is something that I'm going to get lost in. If that makes sense. Um, I love, like, the pop culture aspect of, you know, you're talking about, well, you know, like, boiling it down to one sacred number, and I, of course, go 42.
I was right there with you. It can't be 72. We all know it's 42.
It's the answer to life, the universe, and everything. We just haven't figured out the question. You know, and I mean, you know, if you're going to break it down in Pythagorean numerology, you know, seven is... to me, the second sacred number, if you're going in ascending numbers, it's about as above, so below. It's the merging of God and the divine, or man and the divine. Whereas two is polarity. It's the beginning of the illusion of separation. So it's the breathe out, breathe in. You know, and then you add them together and you get nine, which is completion of cycles in Pythagorean numerology. Is Pythagorean the word I want? I think so. Anyway, Greek numerology. So yeah, I mean, just based on that, I would say yes, it's very definitely a sacred number. Also, it shows up all over the place, so there's something to that. I just don't know if I want to noodle it further than that.
Fine.
It's funny, I check in with my dad on this. He's passed, so I can check in with him on this. And my dad, by the way, I asked him once, because he was really into like deep questions and how stuff works and all that kind of stuff, and he was a genius. And I was like, so most people think in either, like, visual or words. How do you think? And he paused for a minute and he goes, I think in geometric shapes. I was like, what is that even? But, I mean, it makes sense with my dad. But, yeah, when I check in with him on this, he goes, just go back to the geometry stuff. It's more interesting. So, there you go.
So I'd like to just jump off the deep end on a completely different tangent.
Nice. And,
what are your hits with, galactically, what's going on and where, with, it seems like our little humanity project here is having some struggles. And
that's nothing new, though.
Right. But, do we have certain teams we should check in with and messages? I feel like Gaia could use some help.
Gaia's fine.
Well, yeah.
Humanity is the one that's fucking up.
Yes.
But
I would like to see humanity take better care of Gaia, and perhaps there's...
Well, she can always repair herself once we're gone. She doesn't care. Think of Gaia as the honey badger. you know, our concept of time is such a blip in her concept of time anyway that it's a non-issue, really.
Yeah. Just get on with our bad extinction.
Right. And we're doing a pretty good job of that.
Yeah.
So, you know, the information, the more galactic information about, you know, what we're doing and what's going on here and who do we check in with and stuff, a lot of the groups seem to be taking a step back and going, you did this to yourselves, you guys solve it. Mm. Because we did this to ourselves and we have the information to solve it. Change is uncomfortable. We don't like change. Change is frequently, from a human codependent point of view, violent.
Forced to.
Yeah. You know, there's slow evolution, and then there's whatever the fuck this is. You know? And, you know, this is not necessarily a call to arms. It's just, we need to get more people into the concept of solution. Because we have all of the stuff we need, all of the information, all of the technology, all of the base material stuff we need in order to affect positive change and to shift our headlong dash towards a cliff. What it's going to require is A, people getting uncomfortable enough to wanting to do something, at which point it's like, well, you know, okay, so we're going to go through a certain amount of population extinction. And two, being willing to break out of the Maya, the thickness of the illusion of separation and of unenlightenment. I mean, there's a certain portion of the world that has chosen to buy into a new Dark Ages where the energy is dropped and the information is limited. And because the gift of being human is that everyone has free will, I don't know that that's something we can shift for other people, regardless of what the Fluffy Bunny community would like to believe.
Well, can we just keep their free will off of us?
You know, and when you say that, what I get is you are welcome to transcend at any point. The idea of taking everyone with you may be as arrogant as some countries' foreign policy. You know, what you see as the way to go is perfectly valid for you.
Right.
And, you know, what it's, from a spiritual point of view, what it's going to require for you to experience the change you are seeking is to detach yourself enough from the Maya here and just move into that next level up, and the people who want to keep their consciousness and their experience in this space will continue to do so. At a certain point, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. You know, the idea that, oh, if enough people raise their vibration, then everyone will, else's vibration will go, is a nice fairy tale. But it's codependent and it's arrogant all at the same time. Mm. And in the Western Mystery School, their tradition, there is a concept that evil is whatever seeks to violate the free will of a human being. And so if someone's free will is to be mired in the Maya, as it were, okay, have at. The highest spiritual concept I keep coming back to is don't be a dick. And so don't force people to stay there. Don't keep information from them. Offer them a hand if they want a hand. But if they don't want it, it's not my job to force it on them. And it's not your job to force it on them. You know, and the idea that, you know, if 10%, 20% or whatever of the population shifts their energy, then everybody's energy will shift. It's a nice myth. It's based on an old hologram. And it wasn't even a spiritual truth in that hologram. It was part of keeping people in that hologram. It was part of control, is getting people to believe that.
Mm.
You know, because if my well-being is based on everyone else's well-being, the most spiritual thing I can do is practice self-care.
Well said.
And it's hard. I mean, I don't want to, you know, I am human and I do have some of that codependent on my fellows stuff, and I don't want to watch people suffer. And I have to understand that it's not my choice whether they do or not. Mm. That's a hard one for a human to wrap their heads around. But it's a truth, and it's a truth. And, you know, all we can do is our best on any at any given moment, even. And letting other people's reality dictate our reality may be a poor choice. I mean, from Spirit's point of view, it's totally a poor choice. Yeah, but when we do it, we're doing it because we need to experience something so that we can have some kind of an energy. And so people who do that, okay, that is, again, their choice. And I do my best to not have judgment about that. I can say, you know, I can have discernment. I can say, I don't choose that for myself, and I wouldn't choose that for you. But if I'm not going to seek to thwart the will of a human being, I go, and that's your choice, and bless you. I believe that is the end of this podcast. So with that heavy information to chew on...
Live your best life.
Go do your thing. This has been Dave Burke.
Bye.
Lisa Frith.
Bye.